McGraw-Hill Ascent Audio presents Inside Vanguard, Leadership Secrets from the Company That Continues to Rewrite the Rules of the Investing Business by Charles D. Ellis, narrated by Mike Chamberlain. Foreword. The 19th-century Scottish philosopher Thomas Carlyle famously argued that the history of the world is but the biography of great men. It is a temptingly elegant mental framework that taps into our deep-seated human need for simple narratives with clear-cut heroes and villains. After all, this is no archaic prism through which to look at the world. Even today, Hollywood constantly feeds and reinforces our desire for flawed yet brilliant protagonists who single-handedly change the course of history. Even modern-day incarnations of Batman shed the inconvenience of his sidekick Robin. But reality is always somewhat knottier. Knottier, yet more fascinating. If great people can shape society, then society equally shapes great people. As Karl Marx observed in the 18th Brumaire of Louis Bonaparte, his account of Napoleon's 1799 coup d'état, men make their own history, but they do not make it as they please. They do not make it under self-selected circumstances, but under circumstances existing already, given and transmitted from the past. And as deeper examinations inevitably reveal, even the most titanic people and their most impressive accomplishments are inevitably the product of countless others that toil in the background. For every Napoleon, there is a Louis-Nicolas Davout or Jean Lannes, generals and marshals who often do the lion's share of practical empire building. The story of Vanguard often begins and ends with Jack Bogle. It is true that the money management giant was born largely through the sheer force of will of its founder, and congenitally injected with a dose of his messianic zeal. But to reduce the story of Vanguard to the story of just one man is deeply misleading. It is hard to imagine someone better placed to write the true history of Vanguard than Charlie Ellis, who combines the intimate knowledge of an insider with the incisive observations of an industry veteran. Some myth-busting is the result. As Ellis points out, Bogle was never shy about elevating the legend of Saint Jack above the more complex reality. For example, Vanguard's founder would, in later life, see a kernel of his index investing proselytizing in his Princeton thesis on mutual funds. But that is quite the stretch if one reads more than Bogle's curated quotations and recalls that he was an equally ardent promoter of actively managed funds for the first quarter century of his career. Zealous Bogleheads, the moniker adopted by fans of Vanguard's loquacious founder, may bridle at Ellis's puncturing of some Bogleisms. But others may appreciate a more nuanced view of Vanguard's journey, whose extraordinary success owed much to Bogle's incendiary drive, but also to his many able colleagues and successors at the tiller. Wellington's independent director, Charles Root, and Bogle's able assistant, Jim Reapy, were vital handmaidens to Vanguard's birth. The brainy quant, Jan Twardowski, was instrumental in the birth of its first index fund. Although initially an abject failure, it was pivotal in Vanguard becoming something more than a nondescript investment administration outfit. Without John Neff, the fund manager, legendary both for the strength and durability of his stock-picking performance, Vanguard may not have survived the early lean years. Bond chief Ian McKinnon built up Vanguard's huge fixed income division, which has been essential to its success. Gus Sauter may have self-deprecatingly called himself the head of the monkeys, but his importance to Vanguard's now imperious indexing and quantitative investing efforts was enormous. Bill McNabb later steered Vanguard through the storm of the financial crisis with aplomb. Arguably most important of all, Jack Brennan was the yin to Bogle's yang. The assiduous, publicity-shy Bostonian complemented the visionary, gregarious Philadelphian perfectly, but was also instrumental in many of Vanguard's most successful grand strategies, such as its mutually beneficial partnership with PrimeCap. The two men suffered a devastating emotional fallout toward the end, but, quite simply, without Brennan, Vanguard would not have become the disruptive giant it is today. He was Mark Antony to Bogle's Julius Caesar, or as Bogle later saw it, his Marcus Brutus. Even this roll call underestimates the many people who toiled under the mammoth shadow of Bogle to ensure Vanguard's success, and rarely, if ever, got the external fame they might have enjoyed at another organization, such as Jeff Molitor, whose steadfast refusal to allow a tech fund at the peak of the dot-com bubble burnished Vanguard's reputation for investment sobriety and care for clients. Yet what they all wrought is nothing short of colossal. Even today, the magnitude of Vanguard is often underestimated because of its low-key nature and positioning, both culturally and geographically, on the outskirts of Wall Street and its braggadocious denizens. At the time of writing, the investment group manages $8 trillion on behalf of over 30 million customers, which range from secretive sovereign wealth funds and sprawling pension plans to ordinary Americans, Australians, and Brits saving a little each month for their retirement. That makes it comfortably the second biggest investment empire in the world, only outdone by BlackRock, which was built through a series of aggressive acquisitions rather than the steady organic growth of Vanguard. Over the last two decades, Vanguard has become synonymous with index funds, which indeed make up $6.2 trillion of its heft. Yet this obscures the fact that Vanguard also manages $1.7 trillion in traditional, actively managed mutual funds. This alone would make the company, initially started as a clerical outfit, one of the dozen largest asset management firms on the planet. The central cause of Vanguard's success is not difficult to spot. Bogle often joked that he wasn't so sure about the efficient markets hypothesis, Chicago professor Gene Fama's theory that markets are in practice unbeatable by active fund managers, which underpinned the first generation of index funds. But he was devoted to what he dubbed CMH, the costs matter hypothesis, and helped hardwire it into Vanguard's DNA, both through its unique ownership structure and through the Spartan example he himself continually set. Today, Vanguard's innate frugality even shines through in its physical headquarters. Although the investment company is today so big and successful, it has transformed the surrounding townships. Entire business hotels exist around Malvern virtually solely to cater to Vanguard-associated visitors. The ships where its staff toil are dowdy compared to even third-tier Wall Street firms. More pertinently, low costs mean that Vanguard can continually undercut rivals, whether in index or active funds. Weighted by assets, the current average expense ratio of Vanguard is just 0.09%. In contrast, the industry-wide average for traditional, actively managed mutual funds is about 7 times higher, according to Morningstar. In practice, being so much cheaper than virtually every one of its rivals, who have shareholders to please, who demand a certain profit margin and dividends, is, for clients, the investing equivalent to beginning every soccer game a goal up on your opponents. The advantage is particularly stark for dirt-cheap passive funds. S&P Dow Jones Indices, the benchmark provider, estimates that equity index funds as a whole have saved American investors a cumulative $365 billion in management fees since the mid-1990s. A large chunk of that is attributable directly to Vanguard. And even that ignores the de facto gains derived from index funds beating the vast majority of active funds over that time period. Cheapness has periodically cost Vanguard's clients in terms of technical glitches and frustrations, caused by overly modest investments in technology over the years. But there are few signs that the occasional annoyances have impacted Vanguard's upward trajectory. And in 2020, the company inked a huge partnership deal with Indian IT giant Infosys that could transform its reputation as a technological laggard. rivals will be watching carefully. Nonetheless, great success and the overwhelming prospect of more to come raises many questions. BlackRock is a global giant, but in the U.S. mutual fund industry, Vanguard is utterly dominant. It controls over a quarter of the domestic market share, almost as much as Fidelity, BlackRock, and Capital Group combined. Is there a point where Vanguard's success becomes problematic from a societal perspective? Can dominance, although well-earned and a boon to clients, at some point somehow become unhealthy and even harmful? This is a question Bogle wrestled with in his last days as well. Although he scoffed at many of the theories lobbed out by academic and traditional investment groups about the vagaries of index funds, he admitted disquiet about the reality that the indexing sector itself has many of the characteristics of an oligopoly. Although a rare oligopoly with seemingly positive results for consumers, the likelihood of this concentration only deepening in the coming years was not necessarily in the national interest, as Bogle put it. Of course, this needs to be seen in light of how Bogle spent his later years burnishing his own reputation, even if it meant flinging some rocks at the company he founded. But he is not wrong. Vanguard's ballooning size will inevitably start dragging it into some of our age's most contentious issues. Ellis rightly notes, and backs it up with copious examples, that Vanguard is dedicated to doing the right thing. But the reality is that the right thing is often in the eye of the beholder, and many issues are becoming increasingly polarized. For example, some of the company's clients may think it should do its utmost to pressure energy companies to halt exploration, perhaps even some production, to ameliorate the climate crisis. In fact, they may think it has a fiduciary duty to do so, given that global warming could unleash a socioeconomic cataclysm. Other clients may think this preposterous, insist that Vanguard should support companies that are producing the essential ingredient of virtually all economic activity, and argue that it only has a fiduciary duty to maximize returns. Even King Solomon would struggle to reconcile many of these conflicting and politically touchy arguments. Threading the balance between being an overly passive and active shareholder is likely to be one of the defining challenges for Vanguard in the next few decades. Nonetheless, such is the curse of success. Vanguard is today one of the financial world's most consequential companies, and its future looks even brighter than its vibrant past, thanks to several ambitious strategic gambits launched in recent years. Vanguard has now set its sights on doing for the expensive and often substandard industry of financial advice what it did for investment management. Vanguard's personal advisor service, which was launched by Brennan's successor Bill McNabb in 2015, already manages $243 billion. Under Tim Buckley, now Vanguard's latest chief executive, the latest initiative is a move into private equity through a partnership with HarborVest. Although seemingly anathema to the company's mantra on the importance of cheap fees and transparency, concepts not commonly associated with the private equity industry, this is potentially another crucial plank in its advice and retirement business. And who knows, maybe Vanguard is quietly plotting to eventually bring the private equity phenomenon to the masses. Now that would be a revolution. So, grab a bottle of cheap Cabernet Sauvignon, Bogle's favorite wine, and settle in to read Ellis's fascinating and fleshed-out tale of the Vanguard journey. Robin Wigglesworth, Global Finance Correspondent, Financial Times. Introduction. The Vanguard Adventure. The Vanguard Adventure began nearly 50 years ago with almost nothing. A few dozen people, mostly clerks, doing the routine work of administering 11 mutual funds that were losing assets as investors continued to reduce their investments. Vanguard had no role in either selling or investing, the two main parts of the mutual fund business. For these, it was entirely dependent on the organization that had, after an increasingly bitter fight, terminated the man who was the tiny entity's leader. Today, Vanguard is the world's largest and most widely admired mutual fund organization, larger than its three main competitors combined, as it serves over 30 million investors and over $8 trillion in assets. At the same time, it is also one of the most rapidly growing. Along the way, Vanguard has changed the fund industry and is well-positioned to continue driving the industry to change again and again in the years ahead. If you are one of those 30 million entrusting their trillions of savings and investments to Vanguard, as do I, my wife, children, grandchildren, and our church, you will find strong confirmation of your decision to take advantage of Vanguard's low-cost, high-integrity commitment to advancing investment services. If you are new to Vanguard and its remarkable commitment to serve investors large and small, you will learn how its strengths developed, an all-American adventure story, and why it remains the investment industry's main agent of change to the great benefit of many millions of investors. The expressed values and explicit behavior of individuals seldom become the core beliefs of large organizations, particularly over several decades fraught with turbulence and change. But as Vanguard's adventure story unfolds, readers will see how the essence of Jack Bogle's original beliefs became the enduring DNA of today's Vanguard. They will see how a driven, creative, forceful entrepreneur, a self-described small company guy, was outgrown years ago by the managerial challenges of explosive growth, bringing the need to develop an unusually effective organizational system with the many different managers and teamwork. Without Jack Bogle's creativity and unrelenting drive, Vanguard could never have been conceived, launched, or made successful in its early years, and it could never have reached the extraordinary success it has achieved without Jack Brennan's taking over as CEO when he did, followed by the contributions of his successors, Bill McNabb and Tim Buckley. At Vanguard's beginning, low fees were consistently the least important in a long list of the criteria by which investment managers were selected. But low fees became what Vanguard could offer to attract investors and their assets. Then, in an era of super high interest rates, a new type of mutual fund was invented: money market mutual funds. These funds all invested in the same safe, short-term instruments, treasury bills, commercial paper, and the like. And since the funds were so much the same, one factor stood out: low fees. Low fees now mattered to investors. Focused on controlling operating costs, Vanguard had the industry's lowest fees and swiftly captured substantial market share and assets. Before long, Vanguard used that visible edge to extend into both taxable and municipal bond investing. Again, investors noticed, and Vanguard assets surged. As assets increased, Vanguard could and did continue reducing costs and fees. Then the same formula and more good luck propelled the firm into equity investing. Vanguard offered an equity fund managed by John Neff, who achieved impressive performance and low cost. Vanguard's reputation rose among an increasingly appreciative and growing group of investors as it drove costs and fees lower and lower, while other mutual fund managers actually increased their fees. Vanguard's low-cost, low-fee strategy was made possible by its unique structure. Vanguard was and is a mutual fund organization. Vanguard is owned by the Vanguard funds, and hence indirectly by the investors in those funds, so there is no divided loyalty and no need to reward owners with increasing profits the way other mutual fund organizations are designed to do. A powerful externality created an opportunity for Vanguard to build an enormous business in exchange-traded funds, ETFs, and index funds. The world of active investment management has, over the past several decades, changed in many ways that make it harder and harder for active fund managers to outperform the indexes. Most fail. Part of the change has been a Darwinian process of driving inferior managers out of the business, so only the better managers have survived and can still compete. Another part of the change has been an extraordinary increase in both the quality and the quantity of information available to all investment managers and the speed with which information is distributed to investors. All professional market participants have powerful computer systems and Bloomberg terminals with modes to access and analyze all sorts of information instantly. Volume of trading has increased enormously, and, importantly, the fraction of trading done by professional experts has increased from below 10% by small bank trust departments when banking was limited to single states and America had over 14,000 banks, to over 90%, led by hedge funds and aggressive active managers. As a result, the experts must trade mostly with other experts, who all know almost all the same superb information at almost the same time, and so are mighty hard to beat. Costs and fees matter a lot and have been increasingly difficult to overcome. One result is that, over the long term, 89% of actively managed funds fail to equal, let alone beat, their self-chosen target market. This means that Vanguard's index funds and ETFs have been able to grow enormously. In its array of actively managed funds, too, Vanguard's ability to negotiate low fees with managers gives investors a compelling advantage. So does its experience in selecting and monitoring active managers. Low-cost offerings have also enabled Vanguard to build an enormous business as a manager of 401k funds, which increasingly dominate the retirement industry. Looking ahead, simply slowing the rate of reductions in its already low fees enables Vanguard to make game-changing capital investments of over $500 million year after year in new kinds of value-adding services it can deliver to present and future investors as it continues to change the investment services industry again and again. The Vanguard adventure continues. Part 1. Opportunities. Chapter 1. Bogle's Beginnings. Jack Bogle was born into rapidly declining affluence. His parents, William Yates Bogle Jr. of Montclair, New Jersey, and Josephine Lorraine Hipkins of Brooklyn, both born to wealth in 1896, married in 1924, and lived in a large home in Verona, New Jersey. Lorraine lost twin girls named Josephine and Lorraine at birth. In 1927, had a son, William Yates Bogle III, known as Bud, and then on May 8, 1929, a pair of twin boys, David Caldwell Bogle and John Clifton Bogle, whom she called Jack. Named after his grandfather, Jack Bogle looked to his great-grandfather, Philander Bannister Armstrong, as his spiritual progenitor. While in the insurance industry, Armstrong gave speeches, wrote a book, A License to Steal, How the Life Insurance Industry Robs Our Own People of Billions, and tried to get readers to contribute $2.50 apiece to join the Policyholders Alliance and force insurance companies to disgorge their hundreds of millions of dollars stolen from policyholders by dishonest laws, dishonest accountings, dishonest mortality, dishonest profits, dishonest forfeitures, and dishonest premiums. Note. However, in 1907, Armstrong was the president of Excelsior Fire Insurance Company when it was put into receivership by the New York State Attorney General and the State Superintendent of Insurance. Allegedly, $137,500 of the $300,000 invested in the small company was never deposited, and fictitious credits had been created instead. End note. The Bogles enjoyed a few years of high living, thanks to inheritance. Lorraine, her son Jack said, was glamorous and charming, and everybody loved her. William was sometimes called the Prince of Wales, partly due to a resemblance, but probably more because of his carefree spending. After crashing his Sopwith Camel biplane in England as a member of the Royal Flying Corps during the Great War, he worked in sales for American Brick, a company his own father had founded, and American Can, which had acquired another outfit his father had founded, the Sanitary Can Company, when it got into financial trouble in 1917. That way of life was stopped abruptly by the 1929 crash. It wiped out William Bogle's inheritance and threw the Bogle family, including the infant twins, from affluence into increasingly serious financial troubles. The young Bogle boys soon had to work to help out. At 10, Jack delivered newspapers and magazines and worked in an ice cream parlor. He recalled, "I didn't just get the job done. I was super responsible." At 16, Jack and David crossed the first wage milestone. "We earned more than $1 an hour. I earned $1.04, sorting mail and canceling stamps at the Bayhead, New Jersey post office." Financially, Jack learned to be conservative and would always be driven. "I don't think there is anything healthier than learning that you have to earn what you want to spend," he reflected many years later. "It's a great blessing. When you are working at a young age, dealing with the public, you learn about human relations. You learn about dealing with people. You learn about getting to work on time. You learn that sometimes bosses are really tough. And you learn the customer is always right." He also learns to create a self-protective fantasy world of his own enhanced perceptions and to project them consistently and convincingly to others. Jack Bogle always spoke warmly of both his parents. "Dad grew up a playboy, leading a Scott and Zelda social life. He tried to sell bricks, but one day said to himself, 'This guy doesn't want to buy bricks today.' So he went across the street to a bar. He soon became a heavy drinker. After a series of failures at work during the 30s and early 40s, he was fired for the last time. His drinking got worse. He had to sell the home in Verona, and the Bogles moved for 2 years, probably rent-free, into a house Lorraine's parents owned in Lakewood. Then, to cut costs further, they moved down to the Jersey Shore. By 1945, they were down to living in a two-room apartment on the third floor of a modest house in Ardmore, near Philadelphia. In a space between the two rooms were a coffee maker and a hot plate. Sometimes Bogle's story was modified to have the family living in what had been a garage, with young Jack sleeping on a dirt floor. Usually, dinner was at a nearby Horn and Hardart, a chain known for vending dishes through the wall. Bogle quickly explained, "We didn't go to the automat part. We sat down for dinner." Years later, he and his two brothers took turns giving their mother injections of Demerol to ease her pain from cervical cancer. Day after day, she worked in a small clothing shop. "My God, the sacrifices my mother made," said Bogle. "You can't imagine the burden she had." In his late 80s, Bogle continued to cherish memories of his parents and see the world as he wanted to see it, saying, "I loved my father, still do. He did his best. I was goody two-shoes to my parents. My mother read to me The Little Engine That Could. There was nothing bad. I always thought we had a wonderful, wonderful background." After a pause, he continued, "I learned to save for a bike." Another pause. "I do not like to spend money. Never have." While his twin focused on studies and was artistic, Jack and his older brother Bud developed a compelling need to win, or at least beat each other. "We would always fight, and it was for real. Dropping large rocks on each other or hitting each other with hammers," recalled Bud. "It was really weird, the violence. That which does not kill you, as the Prussians say, makes you stronger." Bogle got stronger. Having a challenged family life is a... You survive that or you don't, he reflected. You survive that, and you are stronger than a person who goes breezing through life thinking the world is their oyster. Taking a job when you don't have to is very different from taking a job because you need the money. Bud Bogle learned hard lessons. As he recalled years later, he protected his younger brother Jack from whatever kind of bad things my father got into, which was too much wine, women, and song. I was the guy who had to find the damn bottles of booze and break them in front of him, while both father and son cried. It was horrible. To see what was going on at home was too much for me. So he quit home and went to live in Connecticut with his mother's brother, Clifton Armstrong Hipkins, who worked on Wall Street. With Clifton's help, Lorraine arranged for her sons to get work scholarships to the 100-year-old Blair Academy. Bud graduated.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?